From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks, as always, for joining us for our Week in Review of Connections. I'm Megan Mack. We'll begin this week's episode with a conversation about the possible impacts of a wall built along the southern border. It's an issue explored in a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting project produced by the Arizona Republic. In a documentary called The Wall, reporters examined how a wall along the U.S.-Mexico border would impact security, property rights, the environment, and the economy. In this clip, RIT economics professor Amit Badabial discusses how closing the southern border, a move proposed by President Trump, would affect the U.S. economy. But first, here's Ismael Castellano, an immigrant from Mexico who is a member of the group Alianza Agricola. He's discussing the challenges he faces as an immigrant and a low-wage farm worker. You'll hear him in Spanish, followed by the English translation.
Alianza Agricola es un grupo de trabajadores inmigrantes.
Alianza Agricola, Agricultural Alliance, is a group of immigrant farm workers.
Que estamos luchando para pelear por nuestros derechos.
Who are fighting for our rights.
Bueno, creo que lo que estamos haciendo es como tratar de recibir un poco de lo que nosotros damos a este estado.
What we're trying to do is get back a little bit of what we give to the state.
La mayoría de las personas como yo trabajamos 12 horas diarias.
The majority of people like me work 12 hours a day.
Con un día de descanso por semana o a veces cada dos semanas.
With one day of rest a week or maybe 2 weeks.
Y por el salario mínimo.
For minimum wage.
Y en condiciones que a veces no son las adecuadas para una persona.
And in conditions which sometimes are not adequate for a person.
Y a personas americanas piensan que nosotros estamos robando su trabajo.
Americans think that we're stealing their work.
Pero estamos haciendo un trabajo que muchas personas no quieren hacer.
But we're doing work that a lot of people don't want to do.
O tal vez las personas las pueden hacer, pero ellos no van a querer ganar $12 o $11.
Or maybe that they're capable of doing, but not that they would want to do for $12 or $11.
Y si hay personas americanas que lo hacen y tienen necesitan ganar 15 o de 15 a $20 porque el trabajo es fuerte.
And if there are Americans who want to do it and want to earn $15 or $20 an hour because it's hard work.
Todas las cosas como los productos de lácteos y las frutas y las verduras.
All of the dairy and fruit products.
Subirían de precio, entonces el costo lo pagarían los mismos americanos.
Would go up in price and the cost would be paid by Americans.
You're nodding over there, Professor Badabial.
That's exactly right. I mean, this is, I think, what I was pointing out a couple of minutes ago, that if we were by some magic able to prevent the arrival of every low-wage worker from abroad, legal or illegal, it is just not true that many of the tasks that we typically associate with them would not get done. Yes, there would be short-term disruptions in the economy, but like most other economic features, the wages would have to rise. So if you're, for instance, a hotel employee, a hotel manager, and you want people to come and do your housekeeping, and you can't find anybody to do your housekeeping at whatever wage you currently offer, you're going to have to raise the wage. And that's going to be true across the board. So low-wage, native-born Americans are the ones who are likely to be helped most if, in fact, we were able to prevent the arrival from foreign countries of all of these low-wage workers, irrespective of their legal or illegal status.
What do you make of, Professor, the president's recent calls about shutting the entire border? And that's different than building a wall. When he talks about closing the border, even Mitch McConnell, Senate Majority Leader, has said, don't do this.
Right.
What do you make of that call?
It's a stupid idea, simply put. And you have to trace the evolution of Trump's thinking. So when he was candidate Trump, he repeated this nonsense that he was going to build this magnificent wall and that Mexico was going to pay for it. So the Mexicans have clearly said they don't want any part of the payment associated with this idiotic project. So now, since Mexico is not going to be willing to pay for it, he wants American taxpayers to pay for it. But since we have a Democratic majority in the Congress, he cannot get Congress to sanction the money that he needs to pass the wall. So he, you know, keeps coming up with one antic after the other. Declares a national emergency, wants the military to, you know, divert funds for this or that project. Now talks about closing the southern border, talks about all asylum seekers being animals and things of that sort. So there is no mistaking this simple idea. Closing the southern border would cost a tremendous amount of money, not just the United States, but to trade between the two countries, and it's not clear what the benefits would be.
Next, what caused the water crisis in Flint, Michigan? It's a question answered in a book by journalist Anna Clark called The Poison City. Clark was in Rochester for a presentation at the University of Rochester. In this clip, she helps us understand the root causes of the water crisis. Let's listen.
I think there is that sense that, I mean, there has been this like strong belief that if we run our governments more like a business, they will thrive. And no doubt there are some things that would be improved, some efficiencies, some things that can be learned from the private sector that can improve the public sector. But in, you know, ultimately cities aren't businesses. I mean, when they go bankrupt, you can't close them, you know, like you still have to provide drinking water to people. You still have to provide schools to children. You still have these responsibilities. You can't shut it down when you're having a budget dispute of some kind. I mean, it's a different animal. It's a different thing. And I think whether in the emergency manager system in Flint or similar experiments and elsewhere with that political philosophy, I think you keep running against that same end. I think in Flint, there was a number of different factors that directly contributed to the water crisis. And in one case, I think we're seeing the history of infrastructure inequality that was built into our cities decades ago, where some communities had better access to public services, infrastructure, housing, loans, things like that, than others, explicitly because of race and ethnicity. I think we're seeing the patterns of that continue to perpetuate with something like the water crisis. And also, I think we're seeing how the encroachment on local democracy, how dangerous that can be. I mean, a big reason this problem got as big as it did is because local residents had literally no voice. Like, they did not have the power of their own local government. And when they tried to participate democratically in other ways to alert folks to the growing problems with their water by reaching out to folks at the state, at the EPA, to a number of people, they were not only dismissed, but actively belittled. And that went on for a year and a half, you know, before the state conceded anything. And that was remarkable because this problem was getting worse as time went on and lives were literally on the line.
So our listeners will know that Flint had a water crisis, but let's get a little bit more specific about that. I think most people, and probably I'm sure myself included, if you think about when next time you turn on a faucet or your shower, where's the water coming from? What's the actual source? A lot of people don't know. They don't have to think about it. Again, that's sort of one of the great sort of pleasures of living in this country that's, you know, ideally egalitarian with some of these things. But with Flint, it had changed sources. Why? What's the backstory there?
Yeah, well, the water quality was still good. I mean, that was important. They didn't switch because there was a problem with quantity or quality with the water they had been receiving from Lake Huron for more than 50 years through the Detroit Water Department. But under the emergency manager, who had the full authority at the time, they decided that they were going to join a brand new water system and use the Flint River at their rebooted treatment plant for a couple of years until that new water system was ready to go. And the argument for this was that, you know, we'll be more empowered here. We'll have more of a say. We're not just, you know, forced to play at the whims of this major public utility. There's some legitimate gripes there. Flint was also, residents had some of the most expensive water bills in the entire nation, even before we get to the fact that it's a disproportionately poor community. Their bills, in fact, increased after the water switch rather than decreased. The language at the time of the switch was that implied that, you know, this will save the city money, and it implied that residents would in turn, you know, get some relief from these high bills, even though that didn't happen even before the water problems started. I think a lot of times the austerity, this idea that Flint switched water sources to save money, is talked about a lot. I think that's part of the story, but more and better questions need to be asked about the origins of the switch in the first place, because, in fact, it did not save residents money nor the city itself, which went into what is probably a legal amount of debt, you know, beyond the legal debt limit, in order to finance that new water system that was being built outside its borders. So that's all a little wonky, but like the idea is they did switch this city, its water, with great fanfare. And this idea that getting drinking from the Flint River is an opportunity to get back to our roots and support ourselves. But within just a few weeks, people were noticing that it was alarming enough that they were not comfortable with it.
Should there have ever been a consideration that the Flint River, I mean, shouldn't it have been obvious? I am not an engineer. I am not a water quality expert, but I would have had big questions if you're changing your source of your water. And it turns out, as your book reveals, that there were people who were saying, hey, 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 we're not ready for this. Yeah. We can't go online right now.
Yeah. The water, the person who operated the water utility, this is a big factor in the court decisions right now,
yeah.
was like, I don't think this plant has the staffing or the equipment needed to treat this water source appropriately. And if this goes forward, it'll be against my, you know, like recommendation. But indeed, it went forward.
And so within, almost immediately, it was obvious that this something was wrong here. Mm-hmm. That showed up in many ways. That showed up in when people would take showers, drinking water, you know, kids playing in it. And I think it is very fair to ask, if this were a wealthy suburb and its water looked like this, it tasted like this, showers were like this, would it have been a year and a half before the state acknowledged something was wrong and people really took it more seriously?
Absolutely not. And everyone knows it. I mean, I think if the water crisis had any good come from it, one thing might be how clarifying this was for a lot of folks. You could see this happened so dramatically and in a way that so clearly would not have happened in Ann Arbor or Grand Rapids or another community in Michigan, that it just made it utterly indisputable, the fact that people have unequal access to basic life dependent public services and to democracy too. You know, like there's a lot of reasons this water switch never would have happened in one of those wealthier and whiter communities. But even if it had, there's no way they would have been dismissed and belittled as long as they were. It just wouldn't have happened. I mean, like residents were accused of like faking the brown water, like dyeing it, like just getting attention. They thought it would get, like they were accused of like just doing it for money or what, I don't know what, but people were suspicious of them in a way that they would not have been to other residents of the same state.
We'll end the week with a conversation about a historic production of the August Wilson play Fences happening in Rochester. Actors from the National Technical Institute for the Deaf at RIT will take the stage for the first ever deaf Black production of the play. The performance is accessible to both deaf and hearing audiences. In this clip, you'll hear three of the actors. Malik Paris is a signer for the role of Lyons, and Marquan Holmes is a signer for the role of Troy. You'll hear them speaking through an interpreter. But first, here's Acyon Owens, a voice actor for the role of Troy, on what he hopes audiences will take away from the performance.
It's a double answer in that question. For one, I was doubted myself as being an actor because I don't fit the mold, as I was told, by family. You know, no harm. I love my family, but you know, everyone has that doubt. I've had that doubt from friends. I've had that doubt from strangers because I don't fit that role. And here I am. You prove against the doubters that you can do it. So what I want the audience to take from it primarily is don't give up. If you go out swinging. Go out, hit for that 450 feet, you know? Because that's all it is to you. All life is a curveball in the outside corner. Make sure it's waist high above the plate where you can get the meter to bat on it, and goodbye. That's how it is, you know?
Marquan, what would you like the audience over the next 4 days to take away from this performance of, as Troy, but also from Fences?
Like you said, many times in performance, Troy always says, I want a better life for my son. I don't want you to do what I'm doing. He says, teach me. I want you to go further than I was able to do. I want you to be able to go higher and have higher goals. Go as far as you can. Try to reach outside of your reach, and maybe you'll even be able to hit that goal. Don't limit yourself. You have to think so that you can become all you can be.
Let's turn to Malik, who is the signer for the role of Lyons. What do you remember as your first experience with Fences?
For Fences, I was excited to have an all-deaf Black cast in general for any play, but Fences is such a well-known. Putting on this character onto myself, trying to find his real life in his everyday, taking steps, finding small bits, finding that identity, both as a deaf and a Black man, mainstreamed in really hit me, because August Wilson, the writer, I have watched other versions of the play, and I've also watched other plays of his, and it's very important that he emphasizes the Black community. But for us, as a deaf Black cast, we want to teach our children, our generation, to grow and develop and learn what their own identity is. And that applies to this production strongly.
Fences won August Wilson his second Pulitzer Prize in 1987, considered the most successful play in the Pittsburgh cycle of 10 plays, which of course portrays the struggles of Black Americans across 10 decades. And Malik, I wonder if the genius of of Wilson is at least in part being able to create a play like this that is very clearly a layered script about the struggles of African Americans, but it's also universal in so many ways. People can relate to having parents doubt them, or a father who doesn't want you to do something, or people around you trying to convince you, don't waste your time with music or sports or whatever it is. And I wonder if in your own life, as not just a Black man, but a deaf man, if you have run into people telling you, hey, I don't know if this is for you. I don't know if this is the right idea. Maybe you should not go in this direction.
Yeah, really? The thoughts of my heart, my spirit, my life. I have always wanted to become an actor. That's my goal. So whatever people have tried to say to oppress me or hold me down, you can't, or obviously you're not the right type. I go, okay, that's fine. I just try to explain a little bit from my own heart and my own experience. I do videos. I create my own work if I have to. I try my best to audition and be involved in other productions. I mean, even if it's not a deaf production, I'll give them my resume and show up at the audition. It's up to them to hire me or not. You never know what connections they may have who will come back to me and connect with me, and I'll end up with a job later on. I'm also a gay man. So it's like double, triple perspectives on that. But this character's a straight guy. And like the other characters, I like the challenge. I like, bring it on. Bring on that challenge. If you think that I can't do it, bring it on, and I can prove it. So I think I can change perspectives if you see me. You want to see, you know, what I can do. I'll improvise it. I'll audition. I'll show it. You'll see who I am. You'll see how much potential skill I have, and I'll throw it. I'll throw it into the ring and see. I try to keep an open heart and mind on that.
And Malik, I certainly appreciate you describing how even if there's an audition that isn't for a deaf character, you'll show up, see what happens, you know, talk to the people in charge and see if there's a way to make that role work. Mm-hmm. And so I want to ask about the broadening of opportunities or not, because, you know, just to kind of take one example of how society can struggle with this when we kind of go outside of what we think is quote unquote typical. I think the world had a panic attack when Idris Elba was in the running to play James Bond, you know, a Black man playing James Bond, which, you know, to many theater goers sounded like a great choice, but there was still part of the population that couldn't make sense of it. And so it sounds like it's a process of just imagining more broadly what a role can or should be. Do you see it happening slowly? Do you see it happening at all? I mean, do you feel like doors are opening, or is it still slow?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. There is an impact that is happening across. There's a development of characters, the analysis of characters more, evaluating the plays. Suppose the director hasn't thought of me, but he sees me and he sees I have the feeling, and he might give me more of a chance. More opportunities are happening. I do believe that times have changed. People are more willing. And you have to be willing to change. You have to be willing. For me, every day, there are opportunities to perform. The door has to open. If I have to open the door, maybe it'll let other people in. If I open the door, other Black deaf people will have the opportunity to grow. It's hard to grow and develop through and feel the discrimination and that for myself, and that causes some anxiety, but I just tell myself to go ahead.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and Finger Lakes Public Radio WEOS 89.5 FM. We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I'm Megan Mack. Thanks for joining us again, everybody. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.